Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with Danny Shay, who's playing Valir in the Oslo Repertory Company's production of La Bête. It's not only a brilliant performance, it's a really interesting interview. Danny is funny, charming, spontaneous, thoughtful, philosophical, in a word, really, really interesting. In addition, I'm playing a review of La Bête, and since it's a very long interview, that's about all I'm doing in this show. So, hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Show is all about figuring out if there are things about you that you have hidden, not only from others, but from yourself. If you've been listening, you've heard me say over and over again in as many ways as I can manage to think of to say it, that I believe, based on my many years as a psychotherapist, that most of us learn to submerge parts of ourselves very, very, very young. And we hide them so cleverly from others that in a very short time we forget that we have them. And this might not be so big a deal, except that later in life it is quite often precisely the qualities which we needed to hide as children which we need to resurrect as adults, that we need to be living the life that is most like us, living the life we were meant to live, the life that is correct for us. I think of it as being in sync with ourselves. And one of the things I do in my show, when I'm not talking about this, is interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the reason that I do that, and you'll hear it very, very clearly in this interview with Danny today, is that people who have been able to spend a life, to dedicate a life to an art in our culture, are people who are, at least in the area of their work, in sync with themselves. They are, to use the psychotherapeutic word, congruent. What you see is what you get. So that when they're doing this thing, they are the most themselves. And when you listen to people who have dedicated a life to an art, you hear over and over again, I couldn't do anything else. This is what I was made to do. When I'm doing this, I feel the most alive. I always knew this is what I needed to do. All those sentences which confirm that that person has a center in themselves, and that center is their art. And this interview with Danny is not only not an exception, it's a confirmation. Danny discovered this passion, this drive, what we agree towards the end of the interview is a calling, when he was 4 or 5 years old. And he knew immediately. And I've talked about this and written about it, but I'm not going to say it again because it's so much more interesting coming out of Danny's mouth than coming out of mine. But it was always there. And he was driven. He uses this word over and over again in the early part of the interview, talking about how driven he was as a very, very young boy to be on that stage, to do those things. And that drive has taken him to become an extraordinary actor. And what he does better than almost anyone else. There are very few actors who can do what Danny does. And as he also says, and I don't want to say everything he said, well, I don't have to worry, because even if I say it, I don't say it as well as Danny does, so you'll be interested to hear it from him. But he talks about understanding that there are things he can't do as well as other people, and maybe he might even have wanted to, but he knows who he is and what he can do. And I hope that you are close enough to Sarasota to come on down and see him as Valère, because another thing he says in this interview is that this performance will be like dust in the wind when he stops doing it, and it will only live in our memories. And I am grateful to be someone whose memory in which it lives. After the interview, I'm playing a review of the show by Sharon Leslie, but it's a long interview and I'm not going to talk anymore. So here is Danny Shea. Okay, I am here with Danny Shea in a conference room in the Oslo Repertory Theater building, and I'm astonished that he's sitting up here, because I saw the performance and it must be the most exhausting thing anyone has ever done. He's here playing Valère in La Bête. It's an extraordinary performance and I want to talk about it, but before I do that, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. It's clear that that is true of you. You must have been dedicating every waking moment, is what it looks like, in order to do what you're doing on stage in La Bête. So I always ask the same question. How did it happen? How did it get started? How did it find you? How did you get captured?
My story is like, it's probably really, really American. My parents were not in showbiz at all. My dad's a physicist, my mom's an elementary school teacher. They were from farms and little tiny towns in the Midwest, and had no relationship to theater at all. I gotta say, I think it was Julie Andrews that got me first. I saw when I was, before I went to school, I saw Mary Poppins 3 times and Sound of Music 3 times. And
before you went to school, before you were 5?
Yeah. Sound of Music came out when I was 5. Now I've told you my age. So,
no one will
actually, it came
it.
Out when I was 4. So
are
I
you
was,
saying that you somebody took you to the movies?
My mom,
you weren't having them on TV then.
No. My mom and dad took me to the movies. They were super, super poor. And
they were super, super poor, but they must have loved the movies anyway.
Well, they they did take me to all the Disney movies and some other movies too, and musicals and stuff like that. Yeah, they were pretty good about taking me to the movies.
So, do you? I'm assuming that you remember Julie Andrews.
Yeah, it was like that's what I wanted to do. I mean, she was. If you remember that period, I'm not. You look like you couldn't have possibly been around, but she was a huge, huge star. And she actually, I mean, it's an anomaly that wouldn't happen again today. That particular kind of performance wouldn't have captured the world's imagination, but it did. She was the biggest star in the world, and those movies are still. Her performance in those movies is still really thrilling if you go back, and they're like comfort food a little bit to me. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do.
And you remember it from 4 and 5.
Oh, yeah, I do.
You said...
Mary Poppins and Julie Andrews, and I knew
it. Did you
want to
fly? Did you just want to sing? Did you want to dance? What was it?
Well, I expressed to my parents what I wanted to do, and I think that just because of where they came from and their sort of... They didn't think I was probably going to end up being an actor, but they said that you could be a songwriter. That's what you really want to do, because I like to sing all the songs. So when I was like in first grade, I would tell people that I wanted to be a Green Bay Packer, because I lived in Appleton, or a songwriter.
And wait. I'm just, I can't help it. You said, I expressed to my parents what I wanted to do. We're talking about a very little kid here, so what did you say? I want to do that, or I want...
Probably I wanted something like that.
Yeah,
I want
okay.
to do that, and then they kind of interpreted it for me. And then I, you know, even when I was little, I was pretty driven. I wanted to be in plays and
the school stuff.
Yeah, in grade school. And actually, when I was 10, my best friend's dad was in the music department, was the conductor for the band. And so he got to be in the musicals whenever they needed a little kid, and I was so jealous. Well, maybe he was really talented.
Right.
Maybe he was really cute. But anyway, I was super jealous. And I did talk my parents into taking me across the river to Fargo, North Dakota. I don't know how I did it. To audition for this play at the one theater in probably all of North Dakota, which was the Herb's Playhouse in Fargo.
And you were?
I was like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in this production of Winnie the Pooh that was adults except for me, who played Piglet, and there was another little kid that played Roo. So it was like grown-ups doing, it was like, you know. And it was a professional theater. And
so you got your first
gig. That was my debut.
But it was your first audition and you got your job?
I suppose it was my first audition outside of like a little elementary school situation. Yeah, I did.
Do you remember whether you were excited?
Yeah, I was stoked and proud and into it. It's definitely a thing for me, this theater thing, where it's like I've been really driven. I mean, there's a rational side of me somewhere along the line was like, especially my parents were saying, you should have a backup. But I never really did, and that's cool, and I was pretty driven to do this.
You know, I love this. You've said this now 3 or 4 times. It's hard, really, to imagine a driven grade schooler.
Well,
but I believe you. I mean, I'm not questioning at all. I'm just saying it's unusual, don't you think? I mean, were your friends doing this?
Well, like I told you, I did end up with friends who wanted to do this too. You know, that they were the same kind of people. Most of my friends through my life have been showbiz people. And it's interesting because I don't think about this very much, but the same thing that was when I was little and when I was in high school and now is this feeling of wanting to do this stuff on stage, in front of an audience, work on the stuff. I don't know what it is, that to get outside of yourself and do this other thing that feels incredibly good. I mean, it is like the buzz, and I'm sure it's what athletes feel or probably astronauts feel, that thing, I gotta get into outer space. And that was there when I was really, really young as well.
Yeah.
And it does feel really good. I mean, the Colley Cibber, who's in Restoration Comedy, he was one of the most famous comedians in the Restoration Comedy Theater as an actor, but he also wrote plays, and he was also the poet laureate for George II, of King of England, much to the distaste of Alexander Pope. But anyway, because he was sort of, you know, now he's sort of this second-rate Restoration playwright. But he said, actors are fortune's unlicked whelps. So they're sort of the dogs that didn't get licked enough by my mother. And I'm not blaming my mother for this at all, because she was fantastic. But I think that there is something with actors where they...
Something is missing, and they get it on stage.
I don't even want to say something's missing, but there is this almost genetic need to be... To do that kind of performance and get that...
Whatever
love.
That is, right.
It feels like doing Labette the other night for
yeah,
you...
Yeah, yeah, right.
...felt... You know, when you guys were into it, and I was cooking. I mean, I have to know that I'm, like, cooking on all four cylinders. It feels like pure, unadulterated IV love. Addictive. It's hard to turn your back on that. It's hard to say, oh, I'm going to do something else and not go for that buzz. Chase that dragon.
No, I absolutely understand it. We're describing a kind of addiction, right?
Yeah. Well,
I don't mean this is in a pejorative sense. I really don't.
Yeah. Sometimes people call it, it's like an infection that you can't get rid of.
You seem to have recognized that that would be true for you before you had the experience. To say, I want to do that, before you were on a stage, or... Did you sing and dance for your parents, and they applauded and said, and so you already had a little, are you saying yes to
yes.
that?
It, on a real id level, not a sort of ego level where you're conscious.
No, it was completely natural.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that's true, and in some ways your questions are making me articulate for the first time. Like, people, these are stories of my mother's that I sort of remember, but that someone would say, you know, my relatives, my old aunts or whatever would say, sing us a song, and then I would sing a whole musical. From the beginning to the end. You'd be like, oh my God.
Well, and all right, and around when are we talking about?
This is like, yeah, 5'6".
5'6", right. You know, I've seen this before, but it doesn't matter how many times I see it. I'm always stunned by it. There are people who seem to have come in with it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's ground zero for them. They own it before... They have conscious knowledge of it, or reason to know it, or they studied it, or they saw it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's what it sounds like was true for you.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like my story is this. I mean, there's the story of the New York kids, the kids who grew up in New York in the old-fashioned Moss Hearts, I'm sorry, where they saw their first Broadway play and they were transported. I feel like that happened with those movie musicals a little bit. That's a more real, now American story, that the kids that are grown up out in the cornfields, that's their entree, and it's just as real and valid as the New York kids that took the subway down to see Hello, Dolly, or whatever the story is.
Oh, no, I think that's absolutely true. And
the kids who joined the circus. The circus came to town, they saw it, and they said, that's what I want to do.
That's for me, right, okay. But that's for me. That's what I want to do. That's the thing that so captures me.
Well, it takes till you're. I mean, it's taken me till I'm sort of an adult and to be super conscious of that and own it and be like, oh, this is a really important voice that you should always listen to, and it's going to bring you happiness, and it's.
Well, wait a second. Stop, because I want to back up and I want to hear that story. So, okay, so now we have you at 10 in essentially your first real. Place on stage, right? Okay, so then what?
It was in school from then on. It was like really driven to do stuff in school, be in the school plays, which I was. And
okay, sing, dance, act, everything?
I liked all of that. I mean, I really discovered dance when I was in high school. I mean, I had these real popular culture influence movies about ballet, which is sort of happening again with Black Swan, but the Turning Point, Chorus Line, and all that sort of, Bob Fosse was around my... high school sweetheart was a girl. She was a ballerina, and so that's what we wanted to do. We were, like, obsessed. And we went to Indiana University, which had a really good ballet program. And I ended up switching to theater there. Because I definitely had the desire to sing and dance. I think my talent is more on the acting side than the singing and dancing. I sometimes sing, I sometimes dance, but... Well, I'm happy I have those skills to help me with the theater stuff, pretty much, is how it works out.
Yeah, it is. It looks like, but of course this is my only experience of you, but it looks like words are what it is for you.
I think that has turned out to be the case. Then I did go to graduate school. I got a PhD in theater. It was very directing-oriented. Then I discovered directing. I had another relationship, this time with a guy, who was a director. And then I sort of, you know, I got very excited about that. And I did do a lot of professional directing. As a matter of fact, my first gig at the Offa was as a director. And in my 20s and 30s, I did more directing than acting. I'm glad it's gone the other way now. But I liked academics. I wrote a few plays. I wrote a dissertation. I wrote quite well, kind of scholarly stuff as well. And I don't do that anymore, so because I like the acting so much more.
You know, and this is interesting because just a little while ago you said, so it took me a while to recognize that that voice, I needed to listen to that voice and that that voice was legitimate and that I could believe it and follow it. So is that the voice that says, I'm an actor? Or is that the voice that says, I need to be on stage? Or is it this not one
well,
of the same?
Well, that voice, you know, that voice is right now, that seems like it's the clearest that it's ever been. It's like, yeah, it's like an examined middle-aged, you know, I've been through it all. A lot of therapy and recovery and this and that. So it's like, you know, it's like seeing above the grass of the prairie for the first time a little bit as you get older and you get wiser, I guess it is. And then the voice is like, yes, I mean, take a look at it, Danny. When you are acting, you're happy and you're fulfilled and it feels good and you're not too stressed and you're nice to people. You're not imperious. It brings out the best of my personality and stuff like that. When you're not acting, or it's like you're a little bit more unhappy, a little bit more anxious and not as nice to people around you. So it's like, duh, a little bit.
Well, wow, that is so amazing. Because a number of things occur to me, and I'm back to the, you know, unlicked whelp thing, that it does seem like acting provides something for you that is essential to your well-being, so that you can be all those things, less anxious and kinder. And
it does feel like it's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yes.
Both for myself, and what a great thing to do as a job, or as an occupation or a calling. Thank God there's a union, because I would do it for free, because I love it so much. Is that also, it's like, you know, whatever you think about theater and its usefulness to society and changing the world and all that stuff, it compared to most jobs, it does very little harm. I mean, it doesn't do harm.
No,
it
doesn't.
And then sometimes it does good, you know, it might bore people sometimes. But that's about the worst it can do. Whereas other jobs, like if you're working for a corporation, even if it's a very conscious corporation, or people that make tons and tons of money, except for actors, it seems like it's like, didn't somebody's head get stepped on to make all that money? I mean, I have that feeling. Like, I'm just lucky that I feel like, this sounds all snooty now, but that I'm doing a job that does no harm. It's great.
You know, it's very sweet that you think of it. No, you're doing it. It's so funny that you're doing that, because I think you're right. I'm sorry. It's so cute. I think it is a job that not only feeds the person who's doing it, but feeds the people that you're doing it for.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about art. I mean, Andy Warhol said art is the definition of art is something that's a waste of space, that it's not for another purpose, it's not in order to make money, it's not in order to blah, 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 a specific utilitarian purpose, that it exists for its own reason, and in that sense, I mean, he's being ironic, that it's a waste of space. It's just there to make the world reflect on itself or escape.
One of the reasons that I interview people who make their living or their life within art is because you can't do that in this culture unless it is actually who you really are. That you're not doing it to make the money or to make a name or to do whatever it is. In order to have dedicated your life to an art in our culture, you have to in some way have had no choice. It has to simply be that you're doing it because it is who you are.
Because it would be, I mean, there's sometimes, I mean, addressing them with actors, like really good actors, but a lot of times they're kind of the butch straight ones. I'm doing this this is my job, it's a job, I'm doing it for the paycheck, and it's like, no, you're not.
No.
I mean, that would be insane.
That's exactly
because
right.
You could make more doing the
anything.
Most simple
right.
Things. So you're doing this, actually, you big butch thing, because you love putting on wigs and makeup and getting out there and acting.
And because it is who you are, you know? And that's the thing, I always say this, you know, that I hope that people who are listening hear it. Hear what it sounds like when you are who you are. Because it's not easy to do what you do. If you live near Sarasota or you can get on a plane, you should come on down here and see Danny as Belair in Babette, because you will rarely see anything like it. And it is not easy. I mean, oh my God, what is that, a 40 or 45 minute monologue?
It's over 500 lines in rhyme couplet.
Right.
Yeah.
And with all kinds of movement and the energy level, oh my God, I'm surprised you even are standing this morning, because it must take a huge amount of energy.
Yeah, it does. Energy is, I have. So that's like a gift that I have. I don't have to manufacture
that
energy. That's
great. So you just say to your adrenal glands, kick in, guys.
They do it on their own. I'm super hyper.
Yeah.
And if anything, I need the opposite.
You mean you need to know how to calm down?
To calm down, yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing. What you said was, when I'm acting, I am less anxious. So in an ironic way, does that do that for you? Does it calm you down?
I guess, yeah. It's like it's a vehicle, a receptacle for all that stuff.
All that stuff.
It's like putting it into the art. I mean, I think that's, as actors, theater people, I think sometimes we get really jealous of other kinds of artists, like a painter that can't. They can just lock themselves in a studio and paint for a whole weekend, 24 hours or whatever. And writers, you know, they could do the monk in their cell thing, which I'm sure has its other drawbacks. But we always have to have a place like this theater, and we have to have a time and a place where all these people come together, because it's this hugely collaborative thing. But, you know, I would be happy doing this all the time. If I've been off not working, not doing a play for a couple of months, and I get back in a rehearsal room, even if it's on a, you know, I have a small supporting part in a play that's been done a million times and whatever, I still usually have this moment in that first read-through, in the first rehearsal, like, that this is where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, and it was there, apparently, from the very, very beginning. And what's also kind of interesting about you is that you have a lot of talent. I mean, you can write, you can sing, you can dance, you know, and you spent a certain amount of the capital of your life doing these things, and yet it's really about acting for you mostly, about...
Yeah, well, and the kind of things that I do, I mean, even Labette, I mean, resume, for example, is maybe half Shakespeare, which might get back to one of the original questions about the words. I discovered, you know, Shakespeare, I did play in high school, and in college I took a Shakespeare acting class, and I did well at it, and I liked it okay. And then when I got out of college, I was in a Shakespeare company in Chicago. It was like really kind of guerrilla Shakespeare. And I got very brave with the Shakespeare, and my dissertation at Berkeley is on Shakespeare. So, like, doing that Shakespeare, which is hard, which is like Labette hard a lot of the times.
But actually great training for Labette.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It seems like that's all those Shakespeare clowns that are really hard to make clear, that intricate language and Elizabethan jokes, absolutely was the training for to be able to do Labette. I feel like those things were all in place. In order for me to, I wouldn't be as good at doing this play if I hadn't done all that Shakespeare. And even the Shakespeare outside, like, I was really worried with this part that I would lose my voice, like, because to talk all that time without a drink of water, or without a breath, or going off stage, is usually when you play clowns, you're on in a funny scene, and then you're off stage, and then you're on in a funny scene. But I've done so much Shakespeare outside, where we do lose our voice, and it's, like, so hard, that... I didn't really have, I mean, I'm neurotic about it, but I didn't really go hoarse on this part ever. And that's because of all those years shouting that iambic pentameter out to the birds. My vocal cords are, like, really strong. And, you know, all that singing and dancing and, like, sword fighting and all this other stuff that we pick up as actors, like the ballet... that I started doing when I was 15 or whatever. I did an Arlecchino a couple years ago for Lillian Grogan in California, where I was like doing all this ballet. I was, you know.
You're doing it in this, in La Bette. I mean, you're moving. There are moments in La Bette when you can see that you're a dancer.
All that stuff pays off, you know. And it didn't. There were parts of my career where I wasn't using it at all, you know. So part of the, one of the great things about acting, like with training actors, is like do everything. Like you'll get a job based on the fact that you can ice skate or speak another language or whatever it is. It's like we have to be scavengers of the human experience, and the more useless crap that's in your bag that you tote around, the better, the more valuable you are as an actor.
Okay, so let me see if I have it. A lot of stuff in elementary school, junior high school, high school, college, started out in ballet, switched to theater.
And you know, in those days, I was really little. I was femmy, kind of, little gay boy, obviously gay, even before I knew it. And I didn't know that I was talented enough to make a living for a long time. I mean, one of the things that I was, there was a period when I was kind of tense playing, except for really silly stuff like playing Shakespeare. I remember I did this Romeo and Juliet in Chicago where I played Paris, which is a thankless role because the audience hates him because it's just in the way of Juliet. He's the nicest guy. But I was kind of tense. I was, you know, and that's when I sort of focused on directing for a while, thinking, you know, maybe my true talents lie elsewhere. And as soon as I did that, the acting, like, fixed itself. And then I was playing sort of Shakespeare leads, and, like, a real big click happened with my acting. Sometimes there was a period in my life where people were critical of me that I was too, you know, not sort of kitchen sink realism, which isn't, there are people who do that better than I do, mm-hmm. who do, like, you know, straight drama, straight guy drama better than me.
Right.
I mean, I like to pretend that I can do it in a pinch, but, you know, there's great actors that do that. I wouldn't be the go-to person for that. But there's stuff like this classical comedy stuff, comedy in verse, that not that many people do better than me.
My God, I'm sure that's the truth.
So, like, realizing that, it's like not, you know, sometimes I have these kids come to me, you know, kids that are mentoring or whatever, and they're like, I want to be able to do this. And they can sing and dance, and they're beautiful. And it's just like, all right, fine, you know, I want to play Hotspur. It's like, okay, I want to be able to sing, you know, sing like you do too. But if I'm not saying, like, don't, you know, pigeonhole yourself, but it's more like love the things that you do that other people can't instead of focusing on.
Oh, I think that's so important.
Well.
I really do think it's so important. I think that there's so little attention placed on finding who you are and doing what you do. You know, have a fallback position because it's not okay to focus on who you are, to love who you are and nurture it and honor it and water it. And okay, fine, you have to be a waiter for a while. Okay, fine. But the thing that you are, I'm not being very articulate here.
To sort of move to something a little more political, it's like this, our culture, our country, does a really dangerous thing for artists, which is the report card on who you are as a person is your bank account.
Yeah, it's financial.
How much money you make. That is God's report card. We are taught at the tit.
Yes.
You know, as children. So it's really, really hard for stage actors. And then, and also, unfortunately for actors, there's also the most visible actors are movie stars, and they are making a lot of money.
Right.
And we just don't realize what a tiny fraction, even of TV movie actors, are making these sort of, you know, vast sums.
Never mind vast
really
sums
confusing.
That are making a living.
Right. But I'm very grateful that the money isn't part of it for me. I'd love to have a movie star's salary, I suppose, but it's not like what gets me there. It's like I don't focus on that. I don't have fear and anxiousness around money because I love doing what I'm doing so much.
And that's kind of the point I was trying to make earlier, that people who dedicate a life to an art do it because it is who they are. They might be anxious about the money, but it doesn't stop them from doing what they do.
Yeah, and I would even give that credit to the TV movie stars, whether you think that some of them are talented or not, that I still even think they were driven there by this desire to perform.
I agree.
The byproduct is fantastic, and I'm sure it can get confusing sometime, but nobody would be an actor for the money. It wouldn't make sense. It's scary. It's brave. Acting is really, really brave. And when I say that, sometimes I'm embarrassed because like, it's a brave, like going to war and to be a soldier and stuff like that. But it's, in its own way, it's like incredibly brave because you're out there and exposing yourself and there's no protection.
No, I think it's obvious. Not only actors, but painters and writers and dancers and all those people who choose to give their life to an art are taking a huge risk. It's not only that the finances may or may not be there, it's that the culture doesn't really support it. Your parents are not the only ones who said have a fallback position. You know, most of the world is saying, oh, you're an actor? Yeah, but what do you do for a living? You know? So yeah, I think it is. And I think that the reward is what you've been saying. And it's interesting to me because almost every time you say it, you kind of want to deprecate it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
You know, the feeling that what you're doing is right and it's good and it's honorable and maybe even noble, you know, you get that because you're in sync with yourself. You're Danny. Do you know what I mean? You're not trying to be somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think that's really wonderful, actually.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I've known people who get the same kind of buzz from politics. Obviously, mm-hmm. politicians, I mean, that's a good example. Like, no, they're not doing it for the money. I think they have that same sort of must do this that sometimes defies logic, but it's like a burning thing in the middle of their soul. And even people, I'm not even going to put, some people get that buzz, some people that I love, from making money. They just love it. It makes them happy.
Yeah.
They're just jazzed, and I don't understand it, and I don't do it, and it doesn't sound fun to me at all. In the same way that getting on stage in front of people and having to remember your lines doesn't sound fun to a lot of people. It sounds like torture.
Yeah. It's very hard to act. I think because people who do it well make it look easy, other people don't think it's that big a deal. They don't credit what
no,
you have
no
to
idea.
Do to do it.
Yeah, they have no idea. It seems like, because it seems like prostitution a little bit. It's like anybody can be a hooker, right? Because we've got the body and the voice. We can do that. It's our body and our voice and our personality, which everybody has those tools.
Yes.
So we sometimes get the same credit that a hooker does. And actors, it's really hard to not take things personally. If someone doesn't like your acting, they're saying, I don't like your body or your voice or your personality.
No, no, no.
It's hard not to take that personally. I mean, I was going to say this earlier, but I didn't want to get it. But now I can't. It's like, I mean, I might not even still be acting if I hadn't, like, done kind of examinate, like, the examined life, like, to keep going, finding out about myself. I did many years of Jungian therapy, and I did a 12-step program, and all that stuff is like,
yeah.
I need to use it in, not just
work.
In the work of the character, but also like maintaining sanity in this kind of crazy profession.
Well, it's the other thing you were saying before, the culture doesn't support it in any way. Because unless you're making mega money,
they're telling you you're a failure.
That's correct. That is correct.
You haven't made. I mean, even well-meaning people. It's like you haven't made it if you're not.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, Paul Scofield, when he died, he was the original Salieri and Amadeus, and like it was Peter Brook's King Lear. I mean, one of the greatest actors of the whole century. When he died, I think this was even NPR, said he only won one Oscar.
It's You're like, making that up.
No, it's like one Oscar. He's still a little bit of a failure, because Hillary Swank has two, I guess. So.
But there it is. Yeah. There it is. And that is why it's so clear to me that people who make their living or their life within art do it because it's intrinsic, right? It's not something they're doing in order to prove, in order to be, in order to any of that, which is what most of the world is doing.
Yeah, but you know how confusing that can be to figure that out. I mean, I feel grateful that, yeah, I kind of like really figured that out, that what I'm supposed to be doing, but it can be really, really confusing to get there.
As confusing as it is for people who dedicate their life to an art, the rest of the world isn't doing it at all, as far as I can tell. Most people are not asking the question, who am I, what do I want to do, what do I do best, what fits me, what works for me. Most people are asking, who do I have to be, what do I have to do? And so they're not even asking the question, they're not confused. They're out there trying to be something they're not, because they haven't asked, because they have no permission to ask, because the culture is very clear. You have to either make a lot of money, or you have to be married, or you have to have children. Whatever it is your particular culture is telling you, you know. So people who make their living or their life with an art, however difficult it is to do that, they are, in my view, in the ballpark of mental health.
That's so great to hear.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, that does sound right. And it's like going back to the first thing that you, the first question that you asked me, which is honestly not something that I've thought about that much, that sort of drive. I mean, I go back to the Julie Andrews thing, but like, I sort of feel that way about the, I think the drive being strong enough to just keep you from it being something that you're not. I'm really grateful for, because I think a lot of, if it's not just loud enough, it would be really easy to get off the track.
I think that's exactly right. And the people for whom it is loud enough are the people who give their life and their to an art. And that thing, I tried to talk about this at the beginning, that thing that tells you, this is who I am, there's something mystical about it. Not everybody has it.
What do you think happens when the voice is telling people that and they don't have the talent, the genetic talent or whatever?
Ooh, an interesting question.
And then they get into this, or this is, I mean, to make it really about me and not about somebody else, it's like there's this thing that happens with actors. You'll love this because it's so crazy. Where it's not happening to me so much, but it hasn't a lot, and it so, totally happens with young kids and stuff that are really talented. There's a thing with like auditioning or even opening nights. Why do we get so nervous? Is because there's always this fear that even when you're successful, I have pulled the wool over everybody's eyes, and this will be the moment when I am exposed as a talentless charlatan. Even when you know that voice is a real thing.
Yes.
And until you have sort of a lot of experience, only in the last few years have I enjoyed having the opportunity to audition for people. Sometimes I audition for things I know I'm not going to take because I love showing off in that childish way that's like the opportunity to do it. But that's a hard thing to teach someone.
Okay, but see, what I heard was, there's that voice and I goddamn well do it anyway. And that's the difference.
Yeah, it's like, shut up.
Well, yeah. How useful are you? I'm going out there anyway, for God's sake.
Yeah, but it still makes you sweat.
Yes,
and
but...
it's like, oh, I'm going to be exposed in a public place as a charlatan.
But you see, the difference is that the drive pushes you out there anyway. It doesn't do that to everybody.
Right.
Lots of people, maybe everybody's got that voice, but not everybody gets out on the, you know, not everybody.
And I feel really grateful for that. I feel like that's a gift.
I do too.
There's a God that it comes from there.
Yes, that's what I was trying to say. I do think there's something illogical you know, I use the word mystical. I'm trying to find another word that's not quite so...
spiritual or...
Yeah, there's something that doesn't necessarily conform to the way we think things go, you know, that happens to people, and it quite often happens so young, before there are words, before there's the concept, it's embodied in so many people, and it seems to me it was in you.
Well, it sure sounds like, I mean, this is very, very interesting, because, you know, if I was in a little less relaxed with you, which I was immediately, I mean, I know a lot of actors wouldn't start with that. They'd say, I didn't really, you know, it wasn't until I was in college and this thing happened, blah, 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 that I got into the theater. But because there's pressure to not give too much credence to that.
Yes.
Some actors, and probably me if I was in a more pretentious stage of my life, would not have brought up the Disney musical as an inspiration. Like, I've been on artist retreats where they make up other things that got me into the theater, like blobbity, blah, 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 pretentious bullshit, it seems like to me. Whereas I'm like, you know what, it was kind of pedestrian. It was like the movie at the Cineplex. It was Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke in a cartoon, and chorus line and sort of these things that...
See, I don't think that's pedestrian at all. I think you're doing this to yourself.
It's the truth.
It is the truth. But see, what I think is that it was just the trigger. The thing was in there, and almost anything could have done it.
But what I'm saying is, yeah, that there's a self-censoring thing, which you've picked up in me, but with other people, there's, no, the story's got to be that I was standing in front of a Picasso, and suddenly this other thing happened.
Lightning struck,
blah,
right,
blah,
right,
yeah.
right. Well.
Something more profound than, I saw Julie Andrews dancing with a cartoon penguin, and I wanted to do that. The same thing. And it was more than, I mean, it really was like, as I was a kid, I mean, you're like taking me back. Was like, I must do that.
Yes.
And nothing will stop me.
But see, that I think that is, pardon me for saying that you're not unique. Because you are unique. But in that, I hear that a lot.
From artists, yeah. It's like, it's the old-fashioned idea of a calling.
Yes! Yes.
Right, it's like
that's the word I was looking
for.
Medieval. Yes.
I'm called to be a priest, and doctors used to be like
that. That is correct.
And I feel like that happens to teachers.
I like do
school
too.
School teachers, especially public school teachers.
Yes.
And I don't think that same thing happens to be a banker. I'm not saying they don't get a buzz off of it, and it's not what they're supposed to be doing. I don't think. Like, if there's a God, I think God says, you know, dude, said to Danny, you know, you go do this thing. You do this thing that you can make people laugh, and that's good. That's going to be what it's going to, that's, you'll probably be happy with that. I don't think God tells people to go make a lot, charge a lot of interest.
No, I'm fair. Right, right, and sell houses they can't afford, and like
yeah.
that, right, yeah, right. And
kill cows and put all these cows on a feedlot and kill them and pack them up. And
yeah,
then,
right. Okay, but I'm thinking, the other thing I'm thinking is, and I really, maybe I need to go out and interview bankers, so I'm not speaking from ignorance, but I think it's unlikely that, should I have this conversation with bankers, that a banker would be saying to me, and when I was 2 or 4, I thought, I have to be a banker.
There's probably a couple of them out there.
Well, but see, as I was saying it, I was thinking, what they might have been thinking at 2 or 4 is, I
want to steal that other kid's lunch.
No, I wasn't thinking about that.
No, I was just kidding.
I know.
I think bankers are fun and sexy and fantastic, and I guess there's a purpose for
them. And you need a loan.
I guess so. Yeah.
All right. So, I just want you to think, you know, take a minute, and the question I usually ask at the end, if this is the end, is just to reflect a little bit about what it has been like to dedicate what is essentially an entire life to this performing thing?
I feel really lucky that I've been able to do this. Extremely lucky. And like my parents now are like, how fantastic that you have gotten to do something that you love so much. You know, they're like, they're in awe. They're like, they came to me on another birthday. I was doing a play in L.A. I was playing Nero in this really funny play by Amy Freed called You Nero. And it was a great, 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 great part, you know, like on a level of this role in Macbeth. And they were just like so stoked and proud. It was not, they didn't imagine that it would work out this way. And to be able to, you know, do it at this level and make a little enough money to live on and to have that much fun is like, I am so lucky. The hard thing with theater is, one of the things that I think drives theater people crazy is the ephemeralness of the nature. Unlike painters, even musicians, I mean, musicians in the old days, but now musicians can record their work. And, you know, that's one of the things that I think drives some actors into the TV and the movie stuff, besides the lure of the gold, is, what's it called? Not mortality, but, you know, living your legacy after you've died. Eternity, or what's it?
Oh, no. Not posterity. No, but I do know what you mean.
Immortality.
Immortality, right.
Immortality. And the theater, like that Colly Sibber who I quoted for you, was, you know, we don't know the actors, the stage actors. There's some history about them, but, you know, they're gone.
Yes.
And, like, this show that I'm doing right now, it closes February 21st, and it's gone.
Right.
It's gone into the ether and in a few people's memories who are also mortal. So that's, you know, when my friends get in a movie with somebody like, you know, a movie with that wins an Oscar or has a huge movie star that you know that people will be watching that for the rest of recorded time in some library, that there's a certain immortality to that, that I sometimes long for that.
Well, it's not over.
No. And who knows?
And anybody...
And that said, I still feel incredibly... I mean, that's one of the really cool things about theater, is that it's ephemeral. It makes it more special.
You are terrific.
Well, it's very nice to meet you. You're fantastic, too.
Well, thank you very much. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say?
I think I'm good.
You are good. Thank you, Danny Shea.
And he is good. He is so who he is. And for me, that's so compelling. And I hope that you heard what I heard, which is, you know, someone who discovered really at the beginning of his life who he was and what he needed to do. And you can hear from time to time he lets us see that it was not a bumpy-less ride, that there were struggles and there was difficulty and there was a lot of work, both professional and personal. But he did it all because the voice said, this is who you are, this is what you have to do. And I like to make this point over and over again, that not just for performers and artists, but for us, the rest of us, those aspects of ourselves that we're in denial for, it's not necessarily easy to reclaim them, but it is so well worth the trouble it takes to get it. So I don't have any more time in this show. I do want to play Sharon's review of La Bête, and I think maybe we'll just go out on that. So I want to say, as I always do, a big thank you to Josh Hackney, who is not only my IT advisor for the show, but has just created an entire new computer for me. And so, truly, if you need anything related to computers, to recording, to electronics, to editing, to, you know, pretty much anything, you want Josh. Oh, my gosh, and I realized that I didn't give my website or anything in this show. So if you want Josh, can you go up on my website? And if you want to talk to me, you can also go up on my website, click on Contact Me, and let me know what you want, and I'll get back to you. The website is thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. And, boy, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. I know you heard something that entertained you and that amused you and that probably made you think. I hope that you can use it, that, that it'll bring you back. Because I'll be back next week, same time, same station. And, I hope you will be too.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with a review of La Bette, now playing in Sarasota at the Oslo Repertory Theater through February 20th. When you think of comedy, a broad, rather uncouth character may come to mind, played by such actors as Jim Carrey, Jerry Lewis, Roseanne Barr, or Jackie Gleason. These characters dwell in low physical comedy of burps, gastrointestinal noises, whiny voices, screams, and groveling. They are both charming and off-putting. They annoy us and make us laugh. Such is the character and the conflict in La Bête. The French nickname La Bête is the beast, the fool, for the street performer Valère. Much like Falstaff or Oscar Peterson of Odd Couple fame, Valère is a tour de force for any actor. Danny Shea grabs Valère with gusto in a great over-the-top performance. When the uncouth Valère is invited by the prince to join his royal acting troupe, well, a debate about artistic standards is played out. Elomire, his name even suggests being mired down by elocution. Elomire, as head of the troupe, wants nothing to do with this beast. A wager is set in Act Two. Can Valère's play acted out on the spot by all the troupe measure up to the troupe's high standards? The prince acts as the judge. David Herson's award-winning play, La Bête, is this era's take on the comedies of Molière and Shakespeare. Written in iambic pentameter and rhyme, it plays cheerfully with humor and has been applauded this fall on Broadway. Although the play is set in 17th century France, the Oslo's production dresses it in modern clothes, bright colors, black tie evening wear, and a Looney Tune type set. Direction from Michael Donald Edwards keeps the pace lively and visually fun. I heartily suggest you go see this brilliant play in the Oslo's bright and bountiful production.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I freeze get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper.